Even diligent students of the news have probably never heard of the Palestinian peace movement. On the other hand, in recent months, you have almost certainly heard about some of their accomplishments. For example, the group of young internationalists who sneaked past the Israeli army to bring food and medical supplies into Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity were invited to Palestine and, in fact, trained in nonviolence by a well-organized, dedicated group of indigenous Palestinian activists. George Rishmawi knows these people well. Rishmawi is a civic-minded native of Bet Sahur, a village on the outskirts of Bethlehem. These days, George is a board member of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Among People, a group which was the focal point for nonviolent protest in the 80s. Rishmawi is also the registration coordinator for the International Solidarity Campaign, the group which brought those internationals into Bethlehem in the first place. As well, he coordinates the Travel and Encounter Department of the Holy Land Trust. Last year, the Holy Land Trust sponsored nonviolence workshops for internationals and Palestinians to get ready for this year's Freedom Summer campaign. Rishmawi was just out of high school in the mid-80s, during the first intifada when the nonviolence movement got started in his hometown of Bet Sahur. I asked him to tell me the story. Earlier this year, he traveled to the U.S. on a speaking tour. I spoke to him where he was staying in Brooklyn.
Bet Sahur, Bet means house, and Sahur means the people who were waiting the whole night to hear the news, which is it's a biblical Christian name. It means the shepherd's field. The shepherd's field where angels told shepherds about Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. So this is what Bet Sahur is. Bet Sahur is 85% of the population are Christians and 15% are Muslims. And people have been living together for ages, which is like there is really good, nice of harmony between the people who live in Bet Sahur. And Bet Sahur has been active during the first intifada and well known with the nonviolent resistance.
Tell some more about that. Please carry on with some information about the nonviolence in the first intifada.
Yes, no problem. It's quite a story. When the intifada started in 87, the unified leadership of the Intifada, which is the unified leadership of the Intifada, representatives from all political movements.
Hang on just a second. Could I get you to slow down just a little bit? I didn't get the name of that. Was that an organization, the unified
leadership of the Intifada. Intifada. It's not an organization. It's a committee that used to lead the Intifada.
Uh-huh.
Very, very secret, very high secret committee. And how it used to lead the Intifada used to send out leaflets. And people pick up the leaflets from the street and just follow the instructions. And it's not really instructions. It's just like when there are strike days, and it gives guidelines for the people what to do and leaves really great space of creativity for Palestinian people what to do, like when you said establishing popular committee and popular committees in neighborhoods, establishing popular schools because Palestinian schools were closed for 2.5 years. That was like giving guidelines for and encouraging people for what to do, you know. So that was the Palestinian unified leadership of the Intifada. Now, we took over from there, and we took over certain segments of what the Palestinian leadership has been encouraging us to do. Now, paying taxes to the Israelis, which is illegal under Geneva Convention, paying taxes to the people rather than building infrastructure for us, they buy arms, they kill us, humiliate us every day. And people under occupation shouldn't pay taxes to their occupiers. Mm-hmm. And that is really clear in the international law and in the United Nations and Geneva Convention. So we decided to stop paying taxes to the Israelis.
When was this?
That was from 87.
Uh-huh.
So it took the Israelis a little bit and trying to stop us from doing it. So in 88, what they did, you know, when Intifada started, all schools, universities got to be closed. Beit Sahur High School, there are several high schools in Beit Sahur, but the popular school, the public school in Beit Sahur, turned to be a military base. Imagine your school is a military base for soldiers. Just imagine the impact on children.
Right.
And they still do this until this moment. And there are hundreds of schools closed by Israeli military orders. And all the time we hear them, we hear the Israelis, Palace, you send your children to die. Oh, come on. You close their schools by military orders.
Right.
You know, so close the schools and turn into a military base. Soldiers went out during one day of July, 88, and they started confiscating ID cards from the people. You know, right now, until this moment, nobody can move around without his or her ID card.
George, would you explain just a little bit for our listeners about the ID cards, what they actually are? Because that's something that is completely foreign to Canadian public, I think.
The identification card. It holds your identification number. It holds your name, and you're married or single. But there is very, and it has a certain color. My ID card is an orange, and when the Palestinian Authority came, it became green. But my ID card is still orange. It's a military ID card. It's not a civilian ID card. It is imposed by the Israeli military for the Palestinians to have ID cards.
So now, what is the significance of the color?
I'm coming to this.
Okay.
In the ID card, there are two issues. The first issue that it specifies your religion. It does say if you are a Christian, it does claim that you're Christian or Muslim and you're Jewish. You know? And that you rarely find this in any other countries, you know, that
right.
This is clearly when the Israeli soldier will stop me, he will know what my background is from my ID card, if I am an Arab, if I am a Jewish. In addition to this, Palestinian ID cards who live in the West Bank, it's different than people who live in Jerusalem. West Bank and Gaza, uh-huh. Different than the people who live in inside Israel. That means that from the color of, even the color of the ID card will show where you come from. So people have different colors. So that is very clearly, when an Israeli soldier will stop me, he will know that I'm an Arab, I'm a Jewish, I'm what? So it will be easier for them at the checkpoint to say, go away. It will be easier for them to know where I come from. Not just like this. The car plates, the numbers, you know, the place where mm-hmm. the car number.
The license plate, right?
Yeah. You know, these are different between Israeli cars and Palestinian cars. Even from all the time through the whole occupation period and until this moment, it's very important for the Israelis that these numbers will be different, because it will be much easier for an Israeli soldier to shoot at you, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to shoot at your car, because it could clarify for him this Palestinian car or an Israeli car. And, you know, the funniest part that was that before the Intifada started, they used to issue permits for people to go to Jerusalem, you know, and they could allow you personally to go to Jerusalem, but won't allow your car.
So you could walk to Jerusalem or hitchhike, but you couldn't drive your car.
Yeah. You know, it's just, You know, the very specific details of the conflict, it's really amazing how it really complicates anybody's life, and it raises the level of frustration from this occupation. You know, so get back to my story. They went out and started collecting ID cards. Means if any Israeli soldier will stop me without having my ID card, I am in a big danger. Right now in the country, they will think that I'm a suicide bomber. They will, it's going to be a really big problem.
Uh-huh. So if you get caught without an ID card now, you're under arrest?
I'm under arrest immediately. Mm-hmm. So confiscating ID cards from the people who refuse to pay taxes, that means that those people could be under arrest anytime. So what was the reaction of the town? The reaction of the town that hundreds of people went to the municipality and said, we don't want these ID cards. Take them. Everybody said, we don't want our ID cards. Uh-huh. Hundreds of ID cards the whole day were thrown in the municipality, and people said, take them. We don't want ID cards anymore. You know, it took one day, the whole day, for the Israeli military to be shocked. They would not knowing what to do with this, you know.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so finally, in the evening, they closed the town, announced it as a military zone, which is something they claim all the time, and even especially the April attacks, if you have noticed, that they announced an area as a military zone. You know, any civilian area, any Palestinian city, they announced as a closed military zone. A closed military zone that no reporters, nobody can go in, nobody can go out. And they impose curfew. A curfew is not like you can come at home like from 7 at night and you can leave at 5 in the morning. Curfew means that you are 24 hours present in your house.
And so what happens to you if you leave your house?
Well, you'll be shot at.
Uh-huh.
And actually, 3 weeks ago, before I came, they just killed a man from my hometown because he was out during the curfew. And they killed lots of people who were out during the curfew. So it is really life risk. For me, coming here to the USA was a life risk because I left was still Bethlehem was still under curfew. I passed through villages under curfew. We were really high risk. But there is no way to move, you know. Mm-hmm. And just imagine the energy that, you know, in during curfew, people eat a lot. because it's you're at home and you have nothing to do.
There's nothing else to do. How did you manage to get out? And how will you manage to get back in?
Well, I was lucky. Mm-hmm. Tell you the truth, just was lucky, you know. And people cooperate with each other. And when there's a military patrol passing, people tell you the soldiers are in this place. You have to ask. You have to walk, drive slowly and ask people what's in their way, you know. And depends how lucky you are. It depends how, if you know how to deal with the Israeli military or not, you know. Mm-hmm. This is how it works. Now, for me to go back, it will be, I have to come back through to Jordan. With no way that they will allow me to go back to Tel Aviv. I actually, in December, I was in the U.S., and I have my flight back to Tel Aviv. So they changed the law one day before I came that says if any Palestinians travels from Jordan, they cannot come back to Tel Aviv. They should go back to Jordan. Arrived Tel Aviv, they deported me back. They said, oh, you come from Holland, because my connection flight was in Holland, in Amsterdam. They sent me back to Holland for 2 days until I got another flight to Jordan. And from Jordan, I went to Jericho, then Jericho came back home. It took me 5 days from Washington, D.C. to get to Bethlehem. It's unbelievable. And this time, I'm flying back to Jordan, then getting into Jericho will be easy. It will be okay. It will be very long procedure. And lots of procedures getting into Jericho. We'll get in Jericho, but the difficult part will be leaving Jericho and getting into Bethlehem.
Just the last few miles of the trip will be the most difficult.
The most difficult. The really very, very hard. And I don't think about it right now because I don't want to think about it. I'm just waiting to see what's going to happen. Then I might not go home because I will wait for the advice of my family and my people to tell me what to do about this. You know, mm-hmm. So I might just get in Jordan. They might close the borders any moment. I might get stuck in Jordan. It happens this way. You know, my late grandfather, before the year 67, he used to work in Amman. He used to drive from Bethlehem every morning go to work in Amman, which is like 40 minutes, 1 hour drive, and come back home in the evening.
Mm.
And now it will take you, it took me 12 hours to go to from Bethlehem into Amman.
Oh. And this is because of the checkpoints and the border?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So I continue back what story of Sahur. We talked a lot. So the Israeli imposed curfew, and they started sending the ID cards back to the people, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the curfew was for 11 days, and the 11th day was a Sunday. All the patriarchs of Jerusalem decided to come to pray in our churches. So that was powerful. So mm-hmm. the Israelis didn't find another way just that time just to remove the curfew. So they removed the curfew, but they did not stop their aggression on us, and they still wanted us to pay taxes. And it was like they wanted to break our will, you know.
Right.
But when a community is for each other, it is impossible to break our will. And until now, you know, I tell people, I am living the miracle of the Palestinian people, the miracle that under all these difficult circumstances, we only accept a just peace. We only accept a peace based on the truth, based on our dignity and freedom, you know. And there is no way to accept any other way. We no way to accept humiliation. There is no way to accept occupation. Although there are 4,000 tanks surrounding our cities, inside our cities, are attacking us all the time in cities and villages. Although the settlements, you know, it's so they want to break our will, and it's impossible to break this will when people are standing for each other. This is what happened in the town. So a few months later, the Israelis wanted to still break the will of Beit Sahur and force this 13,000 people, community of 13,000 people, to pay taxes to the Israeli occupation.
This is still 1988 that we're talking about, right?
Yeah, 1988, then 1989. Now,
okay.
We moved to 1989, and that was my last semester at school, and my school got opened in August 1989.
Huh. This is your high school?
Yeah, my high school got open and at August 1990. So my last class at the high school where I should sit for a governmental exam, it was 3 months only, the whole year. The whole academic year was 3 months. Honestly.
How many kids, what kind of percentage of young people actually go to school under those circumstances?
All Palestinian children.
Do they all go, or do most of them just stay away and do something else?
Oh, well, illiteracy in Palestine is very minimal.
Hmm.
Illiteracy is very minimal. But, you know, that time of the Intifada, it's really did create a very bad impact on the children, because after the Intifada started, some of the children didn't return back to school. Not just like this. When they returned back to school, they returned back to school really, really weak. It shakes the basis of their education.
Right.
So so what the Israelis did, they announced curfew once again, and they closed the town for 40 days. And they will come to your house or say, do you want to pay taxes? Tell them no. They start confiscating all the furniture of your house. They will take all of your house, all your car, the gold of your woman, gold of your wife. They will take all the groceries, they would take all the pharmacies, they would go to factories, take all the machines, all the raw materials. In 40 days, they confiscated what equals $4.5 million. $4.5 million.
From one community.
From one community. That destroyed the infrastructure of the community, infrastructure of the town, which is a way more and more of what people should pay, if the people should pay for the Israelis, you know. And it was amazing how the community said, no way, no one penny for you. We are not paying you anything. Take whatever you want. You know, confiscated pharmacy, and the medicine expires at a certain time.
Right.
You know. They took all of this and they sold it, you know. And, you know, our main slogan, it was adopted from America, no taxation without representation. And it's not just like this. When Arab countries wanted to take a resolution in the United Nations to send these goods back to Bet Sahour, there was a veto in the Security Council against our hometown. You just imagine the superpower America takes a veto against our little town. That's enough for us to feel very, very, very powerful that of what we have done. That's really enough to make us very, very proud of what we do and to continue doing this. And the other thing that Bet Sahour has been a candidate for Nobel Peace Prize at the time. You know, that's my background. That's why I come, where I come from. This is the town I come from.
I'm Jim Terrell, and I've been exploring nonviolence in the Middle East. Today, I spoke with George S. Rishmawi about the history of Palestinian nonviolence in his home village of Bet Sahour. If you'd like to comment on anything in today's program, call Kootenai Co-op Radio at area code 250-352-9653.